Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It's an insider's look at the NBA and the culture surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yeah, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
The Volume.
The 82-game preseason is in the books, and now it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same-game parlays, live betting, odds boosts, and so much more. The Boston Celtics are currently the favorite at plus 160, but the team that's third in my championship rankings, the Dallas Mavericks, you can get them on DraftKings right now at plus 1600 to win the title. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code HOOPS. That's H-O-O-P-S. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code HOOPS, H-O-O-P-S, only on DraftKings. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER, or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY to 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario, bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources. All right, welcome to Hoops Tonight here at The Volume. Happy Monday, everybody. Hope all of you guys are having an incredible start to your week. We have the guys from Nerd Sesh, Logan and Carson, coming on the show today. We're going to bounce around the first round. We're going to hit on four different series from a bunch of different perspectives. We're going to talk about the rise of Anthony Edwards, whether or not the Wolves are the biggest threat to beat the Denver Nuggets, where the Phoenix Suns go from here. And we're going to talk a little bit about Lakers Nuggets and whether or not that series has any potential to get interesting down the stretch. Mavs Clippers tied at 2, heading home for game 5 for the Clippers. That's going to be an interesting one. And then we're going to get into Sixers Knicks, which is at 3-1. But there's some optimism on both sides. So we're going to talk about whether or not that series is over. You guys know the drill. Before we get started, subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel so you don't miss any more videos. Follow me on Twitter at @_JasonLT so you guys don't miss show announcements. Don't forget about our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts under Hoops Tonight. And keep dropping mailbag questions in the YouTube comments so we can hit a couple more throughout the end of this playoff run. All right, Logan and Carson. So I go to check on last night's game. Last night we ended up taking the evening off, spent some time with my friends. It was a very nice evening to kind of relax for a little bit. Then I get on my phone and there's a video going around. And it's Anthony Edwards with one of the most preposterous dunks given the stakes and the situation that I've ever seen. And this morning I sit down over my coffee and I watch the game and I am completely blown away by what I'm seeing from Anthony Edwards, because lost in the shuffle of the dunk was this ridiculous hook pass around a double team that hit Mike Conley in the left corner for three, a nasty pull-up jumper in a ball screen where he elevated at the elbow, this weird drifting kind of sidestep three in the left corner, a 30-foot bomb that he hit from the top of the key. It was just big play after big play. Devin Booker tries to dunk, and he just somehow meets him up high, swats him out of bounds, and points at him and flexes at him. This is unbelievable, like future of the league altering stuff that we're seeing from Anthony Edwards. And to be clear, I feel like all three of us have been super high on Ant, and we've all known that this was his potential. But he's getting there way, way, way faster than we thought he was going to. He's basically there right now. He's on the tier with the guys at the top of the league. That's the level we're seeing from Anthony Edwards. So far in this playoff run, 31 points, 8 rebounds, and 6 assists per game on 65% true shooting. Substantial leaps over his regular season numbers. This is stuff that is special. Am I using too much hyperbole here, or is Ant really worthy of this type of praise? Carson, why don't you start us off?
This is incredible what we're seeing right now. He is playing clearly at the level of a top 10 guy just over the scope of this series. And Ant has always scaled quite well to the playoff environments in the small sample size that we've seen from him, largely because of the fact that the dude is just an unstoppable athlete in downhill force. And he is so strong that he is just able to impose himself and gets where he wants around the rim. But what has been so outstanding, really over the three playoff series that we've seen from him, but particularly this series, is the ridiculous shot making. Like, yes, he has had some remarkable drives and he has pressured the paint. But when you think about game one, that 18-point third quarter, that is all pull-up jumpers. You think about how he closes out this one. As you mentioned, it is primarily incredible perimeter shot making. And the leap that we see from him is incredible. He shot 44% on pull-up jumpers in terms of effective field goal percentage this year, which was one of the lowest numbers among high-volume shooters in the league. Right now, he's at 55% through this series, which is an elite number. And that leap has somehow been consistent in last year's playoff series and the year before that. So he has to sustain that to be playing at this sort of ridiculous, overwhelming level. But the shot making from mid-range, off the bounce from beyond the arc, has just been sensational. And we can focus on the special scoring because, like, that is the lead story here. But this man is also very clearly right now one of the 10, 15 best perimeter defenders on the planet. And Jaden McDaniels is the star of the perimeter defense, and Rudy Gobert is the star on the interior. But what Ant has done consistently, applying ball pressure with this overwhelming length, I mean, some of the plays that he has made as a helper, blowing up a Devin Booker block in this game, he's had multiple plays like that. Some of the high IQ plays that he's made, forcing turnovers, generating steals, like, it's unbelievable. And then when he's mostly making good decisions as a playmaker, and he had some really impressive passes, like, there are still moments where the Suns were able to trip him up with doubles and he over-dribbled and he took too long to make a decision. But for the most part, generated good offense. And then Minnesota just has so many capable ball handlers and decision makers and shooters that if you give them an advantage, they've been able to effectively attack. It's incredible what we're seeing from Ant. And the biggest test that he has had to face is, can you hold up as a decision maker and can you hold up as a pull-up shot maker? That was clearly how Phoenix was going to test him from game one of this series, consistently sending doubles his way, sending hard help. And for the most part, he really has. I don't want to overreact just to four games, though, especially in a favorable matchup against a team that is lacking in point of attack defense and is lacking in rim protection. And when Ant has been so much better as a pull-up shooter than we normally expect from him. This dude is really, really great. But you still see a clunker in game two where those pull-up jumpers aren't falling. And, like, that's a lower floor than you see from a lot of the guys who we want to say Ant is playing at that level right now. It's incredible. It is absolutely a rising moment for a superstar. And to do this at 22 years old in your fourth year, that is absurd. To be convincingly the best player on the floor in a series with Kevin Durant and Devin Booker, that is remarkable. And when he's playing at this level, Minnesota is just a title contender, period, point blank. With this defense that is one of the best that we've seen, if not the best in the last decade, with an offensive supporting cast that is delivering, and with him playing at that superstar level, bona fide, where right now you feel like he could go toe-to-toe with a lot of these established superstars, Minnesota is playing as well as anybody.
They are, and I think the most remarkable thing about Ant, too, Carson, you briefly touched on it at the end, is his poise for how young he is, man. This is a big stage for a guy who doesn't have a lot of experience. He already has the most 30-point playoff games in T-Wolves franchise history. This is the first sweep in T-Wolves franchise history, man, and the boys did that. But it is his poise, man, his mentality. That is the one thing that I think that maybe why we can expect more of this from Anthony Edwards. I agree with you, Carson. I think the pull-up shooting is just bound to balance itself out a little bit, where he's going to have a few more duds, and I think that he's going to go up against better defensive personnel. But I've said this all playoffs long, and I said this coming in, man. Ant's mentality, he is just bred for the moment. Like, Ant is one of the most mentally tough. I don't know if you saw this one, Jason. I mentioned this on our show. He went on with SVP, and SVP asked him about his mentality, and he – this is his quote: "I just want to kill everything in front of me, man." Like, Ant is just one of the fiercest, nastiest competitors. And I think in these high intensity moments, I know it's a cliche, like this guy just steps up to the moment, but Ant gives me that. Like, I have this, he feels like a superhero almost. You know what I mean? It's like mythical. Like, I want to get Ant his cape, man. Again, I think it's going to balance out a little bit, but his poise and his control offensively over the game for how young he is so impressive to me. Like, Carson, you touch on the playmaking. That's been one of the things I've been most impressed with in this series, dude. Realizing that there's doubles on the back end, realizing that, you know, just knowing when to pass the ball. These are things that younger Anthony Edwards a year or two ago, he would have driven into a crowded paint. You know, he would have settled for a tough jumper when there's a double coming. Like, he is taking what the defense gives them and making them pay every time. And you're right, dude. This level that he's at, I agree with you, dude. I think the T-Wolves are a legit contender, and he's at a top 10 level right now. I'm waiting for him to come back to earth, but I don't know, man. I think Ant just might be that guy, and this might be the guy that we get the rest of the run, dude. He's special, man. He's super special, but this is way ahead of schedule, guys.
The mentality is so funny to me because it's like respectful, like deeply respectful. And like, there's a certain amount of like him honoring his peers and honoring the people that came before, but it's like mixed in with shit talk. So it's like, it's so funny. Cause it's almost like, he's like, yeah, you know, Kevin, you're my guy, you know, you're my favorite player, but by the way, you know, I'm busting your ass, right? Like, it's very much like this, like, it's very much this like hilarious, like authentic yet respectful, like trash talk confidence that he has that I really like. I think we've all three of us have had Ant as like a guy that we think is wired the right way and that is has the potential to become the best player in the league one day. That's always been a capability of his. It's all about the timing. And again, like, you know, we had pessimism surrounding the Wolves, primarily centered around their half court shot creation. And for the record, 26-5-5 on 58% true shooting in the regular season. And so that was kind of what we were basing that on. 31-8-6 on 65% true shooting in the playoffs. That's a different player. That does fundamentally alter the calculus of the team. I also thought Mike Conley was way better in this series, particularly with his shot making, than I was expecting. They just have kind of aced that test. And you know, it's funny because like there are spots where I agree with what you were saying, Carson, and spots where I disagree. In terms of like game two, for instance, game two to me was actually a really interesting case of Ant's development in the sense that his pull-up jump shot wasn't falling. But there was an important stretch in the third quarter where he was beating the hedge and recover they were throwing at him with Eubanks with the pass. Instead of with, you know, stupid, you know, forcing shots and forcing and over penetrating and stuff like that. And I thought between that and what he did defensively in that game, I thought it was a pretty strong indicator of a high floor for Ant. And like, honestly, when it comes to pull-up shooting, there's really never been a pull-up shooter in the history of the league that's like not capable of having two or three games in a series where he doesn't shoot as well. That's just kind of part of the deal. I think the reason why his pull-up shooting has translated so well to the playoffs has a lot to do with the physicality and his athleticism. Like a couple examples, like that turnaround left shoulder fade he hit over Bradley Beal in the fourth quarter. He just gets such great lift and such great separation compared to the other athletes in these situations. The dead giveaway too is like when you get great lift, you can actually see it in the release from the shooter where you can just tell he's got that like feathery, like snap of the wrist at the end. Whereas like when a player doesn't get enough lift, he kind of has to chuck the ball a little bit. And so it looks a little more janky in the release. And like Ant raised up for like a 30, 32 footer at the end of that game. And from the top of the key, and you could just see he got such great lift because he's so athletic and he's got the stamina that a lot of these guys don't have in this situation, that he's able to just kind of rise up and knock shots down. But where I do agree with you, Carson, is like Ant being this good changes the calculus. It simply does. If he's this good, it goes from, you know, a Wolves team with this defense that does not have high level half court shot creation is a lower level contender. With Ant playing at this level and with Conley playing the way he's playing, and honestly, the whole team is feeding off the confidence that Ant's bringing to the table, all of that together, I absolutely think that this team can win a championship. And I would just go, I'll take it this far. They've been, in my opinion, the second most impressive team in this first round. And by the way, as far as like whether or not Ant's playing at a top 10 level, Jokic is the only guy playing better than him right now. There's no guy out there. There's no player you can point to and go, that guy's playing better than Ant, except for Nikola Jokic right now. And so like that's, again, now sustaining is what you have to do to maintain that spot. Mm-hmm. But through four games, the Wolves have been the second most impressive team, in my opinion, and Ant has been the second most impressive player. So now the group that's in front of them, the Denver Nuggets, they obviously are in a little bit of a situation with the Lakers where they're going to have to win one more game. And there's some stuff there that we're going to get into when we get into that series. But I do believe the Nuggets will win, and NBA history tells us they will win. So, and we'll start with you, Logan. Do you view the Wolves as the biggest threat to the Nuggets at all in the league, let alone in the Western Conference? And that means we're including Boston in that equation.
I do. Boston's always going to scare me. I'll preface this and I'll get Boston out of the way real quick. Boston just scares me because I've seen enough of these dud games from them where they're just not engaged defensively. They're just getting, you know, killed from behind the arc. We've seen that movie so many times. I know what bad Boston looks like. Minnesota specifically, one, my chief concern is who takes on the task of guarding Anthony Edwards on the perimeter. You know what I mean? The reason that Phoenix was throwing so many bodies at Ant was because nobody could hold him. Like, it was just so easy. Whatever he did, he just exploded, and he was at the mid-range. He was at the rim. It was, you blink, and he's there, you know? So Phoenix had to divert that kind of defensive attention. And I wonder if Denver has to do the same thing. Like, I don't know who stays in front of Ant. I think Denver has better personnel, but it's like when you move, like, say you wanted to put Aaron Gordon on Anthony Edwards, for example. Well, then on the backside, you're just losing size in a different matchup where, you know, the Timberwolves are huge, where you're putting a small guy on Cat now. And so I think physically, along with that, they match up really well with Denver in just terms of size and bodies they can throw at Jokic. Like, I mean, I think the biggest variable is what we touched on. Is Anthony Edwards going to play at this level? Like, if he's not, then, you know, I don't think they have a shot at beating Denver. But the rest of the team is playing well too, dude. Outside of Ant, because it all starts with him, right? That's when I'm talking about them throwing bodies at him too. The ball movement, I thought, has been amazing for Minnesota. I think they're deeper than Denver as well, too. Like, this bench, man, having guys like Nikhil Alexander-Walker able to come off the bench, Naz Reid, like Kyle Anderson. They've just got a lot of guys that can give them solid minutes, too. A lot of different lineup combinations. All the guys can space the floor. The Nuggets are deep, man. They can shoot. They have a rock-solid defensive formula. And I don't know who can stay in front of Anthony Edwards. Like, yeah, I do think they're the best shot at the Nuggets. And I wonder if – I don't know if the winner of that series is going to go on to win the title. I wonder if, you know, the winner of that series should be the favorite. I think that's my most highly anticipated matchup of this playoff field, man. More than maybe even the hypothetical of Denver-Boston. We'll get there when we get there. But by far, this is the series I'm most excited for, and I do think the Timberwolves pose the biggest threat. Just especially the way that they can negate, like, Denver's rebounding advantage too, man. The Wolves play with this, like, tenacity, dude, where every ball that goes up on the glass, it's three or four guys collapsing and coming in. And I think they can match that, dude. I was not expecting this at all from Minnesota, man. I thought it was another year. I thought it was 2 years away where we needed this thing come to fruition. I do. I think they're the biggest threat to Minnesota, even more so than Boston.
I'm still going to slightly give the nod to Boston for now. But Jason, you say that Minnesota's been the second most impressive team in the first round. To me, they've clearly been the most impressive because that Denver team isn't nearly playing up to the level that we know they're capable of. Minnesota just delivered an ass-kicking of epic proportions, and they consistently dominated Phoenix. They played a level of defense both on the perimeter and the interior that nobody in the league can match. They dominated the glass. And they were able to destroy them with so many different combinations of personnel. They were able to still convincingly win game two when Ant is off as a scorer and Cat is off as a scorer. They were able to convincingly win the minutes with Cat off the floor when he was in foul trouble because Nickeil Alexander-Walker has been so good. They have so many competent and really high-level perimeter defenders who are then also good shooters and decision-makers. Like, there was just no reality in which Phoenix was even going to be competitive in that series. That was incredible what we just saw from Minnesota. And the scariest thing is Ant's ascent, seemingly, to being at this legit superstar level and what that does for the entire team offense, because that was the concern with this team. I still had Minnesota as my number four contender overall going into the playoffs because I believed in this defense being so exceptional and I really liked their physical advantages, but the concern was, can they produce at the level necessary in the half court to have the ceiling to knock off a Denver? They just posted the best offensive rating of any team in the playoffs so far in this series. And so that is a meaningful difference. And it makes them a terrifying matchup for Denver because we already know they match up physically way better than anybody else. They guard Denver way better than anybody else. They have absolute hounds at the point of attack for Jamal Murray, who has really struggled in this series and now has a calf strain seemingly. That does not bode well when you have to deal with Jaden McDaniels and you have to deal with Anthony Edwards and Nickeil Alexander-Walker. They have consistently guarded Nikola Jokic better than anybody else. He went on this unstoppable run throughout the playoffs last year. I think if you take his stats outside of the Timberwolves series, he averaged something like 33 points per game on 67% true shooting. And in that series, he was at like 27 a game on 57% true shooting. He still gave them work, but he had to work a lot harder than anybody else because they have multiple looks they can throw at him. Gobert in single coverage will guard him as well as anybody on the planet. But even more effective, I would say, has been putting Cat on him as the primary post defender because Cat guards him better than most teams' best center because he's so huge and he's physical and he's really been up to the challenge of that matchup. And then having Gobert in the roamer role, it's like an infinitely better version of what we've seen the Lakers try to do with Rui, which is just kind of ridiculous because Rui can't hold up even close to how Kat does as Jokic's primary defender. So they're checking so many boxes, dude. The depth is exceptional. Naz Reid and Nickeil Alexander-Walker are two of the best bench players in the playoffs, period. Denver, that bench has looked concerning to me. This is a major challenge for a Denver team that hasn't been playing at a convincing enough level to where you can just like check this off as an automatic win. Certainly, if these teams stayed at their current level, Minnesota would win that series. I believe in Denver being the better team. I believe in them playing at a higher level than they have, and I would pick them, but it's not close between anybody else out West. Like, Minnesota has very clearly climbed into the Boston-Denver tier that I felt was kind of impenetrable. I felt it was those two teams and everybody else all year. And now the teams that I had alongside Minnesota, Dallas, they're just not playing at nearly as convincing a level.
Well, to put it simply, you went from going from a guy that's in the, you know, 8 to 15 range to a guy that's in the somewhere in the 1 to 5 range. Like, that's the difference in terms of talent. And like coming into this playoff run, we all viewed the Wolves as the team that could certainly do the most to Denver defensively.
Yeah.
They have a lot of clean matchups. Like, they, I think they would just put Jaden McDaniels on Jamal Murray. We know that Jaden is, in my opinion, the best perimeter defender in the league, and he can do some real damage there. Did a really good job on Devin Booker in this series for the most part. I think they would put Ant on Michael Porter Jr. I think they put Conley on KCP. And I think they would just trust Ant to be the best closeout guy to be able to sprint back to MPJ and chase him off the line with the athleticism to contest. We all knew that they had that capability defensively. But the offensive end of the floor, just Denver is a substantially bigger and better defensive squad. And so there's no doubt that that's going to be a bigger challenge. And my pessimism surrounding the Wolves going into that matchup before seeing Ant at this level would have simply been that Denver would do a better job of slowing down Minnesota's offense. than Minnesota would do to Denver. That very well may be the case, and that's probably why I'm going to pick Denver. But I agree, that gap has closed substantially just because, for one, Ant looks better and Jamal looks worse. And that's just a substantial kind of gap closer, so to speak. And so I do think the Wolves have that potential. I think there are certain matchup things that will be interesting over the course of the series. Like, I believe Denver guarding Minnesota will KCP obviously is a guy that theoretically matches up well, but we just saw, I mean, Bradley Beal's a better athlete than KCP, and he had no chance against Ant in the last series. And so I think there will be an athleticism and size advantage there. I wonder if we'll actually end up seeing Aaron Gordon spend any time on Ant, but then you have the Karl Towns problem. So that could be an issue. Like, I think we'll see the high drop coverage, kind of similar to what Frank Vogel showed to Ant to try to kind of test his playmaking. But he made the plays for the most part in that first round series. And so, again, it's going to be a different challenge. That, like, the half court offense stuff is crazy. So Minnesota had scored 105 points per 100 half court plays against Phoenix. That was the third best half court offense number in the NBA behind Indiana and Boston. Here's a big factor that will probably shift in the Denver series. The Wolves grabbed 40% of their own misses in the half court. Yeah. So, like, that's insane. And Denver, obviously, especially with their starting five, is just a much better defensive rebounding team. So it'll be an interesting series. But yeah, like, there's no doubt that it's going from before the series, before the playoff run, if you would have just told me, like, hey, Wolves and Denver are going to meet in the second round, who do you got? I would have been like, Denver comfortably. You know, you guys know I had the Wolves down at like 8 in my contender list because that was how pessimistic I was about their half court offense. And Ant just taking this leap and vaulting them up fundamentally changes the calculus. And now it's a group that I think has a real puncher's chance to win the trophy, let alone to get past Denver. As far as the Minnesota Boston element, Boston from a talent perspective, I think has the capability to beat Denver. And I do think Boston has a chance. And if they do meet in the finals, I'd give Boston a good chance. But I think actually Minnesota has a better chance to beat them than Boston, simply because they have this like very clear identity that's forming, which is like they defend like crazy every single night, which we have seen for Boston is not part of their identity. Game 2 against Miami was one of the worst playoff defensive efforts I've seen from a serious team ever in my time covering the league. And in addition to that, there's like a little bit of a funky hierarchy in Boston. They still don't really know what they like to go to in pivotal situations at the end of games. It's very clear, as you see down the stretch of the Suns series, like they run their stuff. But once it gets into the final, you know, 6-7 minutes of the fourth quarter, it's just a steady diet of Ant. And he's just going to work on all these different spots on the floor. I think that they are a better defensive team with better defensive personnel. I think Minnesota is playing right now at a level that is more capable of bringing the consistency you need to hang with Denver, whereas I think Denver would capitalize on Boston's down stretches, and that could be an issue. So I think both teams have a good chance to beat Denver, but I think the Wolves actually have a little bit better of a chance.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider's look at the NBA and the culture surrounding the league. Every week, the 5-time All-Star and number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. CJ will bring his A-list comedian buddies to keep it light and fire off some hoops takes. Plus, John will be inviting current and former NBA players, friends, and teammates to join the show as well to give their unfiltered accounts of what really goes on in the league from a player's perspective. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Does the craziness of everyday life leave you feeling stressed and shedding? Since having kids, have you started to see a little more of your scalp? Are you unhappy with your hairline? When it comes to thinning hair, there are many root causes at play, and Nutrafol addresses them through a multi-targeted, whole-body approach. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, and faster-growing hair with less shedding. Physician-formulated, with drug-free ingredients, Nutrafol supports healthy hair growth from within by targeting key root causes of thinning: stress, hormones, environment, nutrition, lifestyle, and metabolism, through whole-body health. Take their hair wellness quiz at Nutrafol.com for a personalized hair health plan based on your specific root causes. With Nutrafol, building a hair growth routine is simple. Purchase online, no prescription or doctor's visits required. Free shipping and automated deliveries ensure you'll never miss a day, and you'll see results in 3 to 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker and healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code HOOPS. That's H-O-O-P-S. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and stylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com, spelled N-U-T-R-A-F-O-L.com, promo code HOOPS, H-O-O-P-S. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code HOOPS. So before we move on to Lakers Nuggets, I want to talk a little bit about the Suns, because they're going to be the biggest story around the league today for obvious reasons. So you're the Suns. You make a trade where you send Cam Johnson and Mikal Bridges and draft compensation to the Brooklyn Nets. You get Kevin Durant, right? You lose in the second round to Denver, but you get two games off of them on the strength of some historic pull-up shooting from Devin Booker, like just off-the-charts pull-up shooting, right? Then we go into the offseason, and they make a trade, which I think was a smart trade. When you factor in what was handed out, you're not going to get a player the caliber of Bradley Beal anywhere else in that sort of deal. Now, obviously, you tied yourself up from a cap perspective for a while with Beal, but you've made a simple talent exchange that makes your team better. Then at the deadline, you go after Royce O'Neal, and that kind of I think they ended up having to use a first-round pick on that one as well, if I remember correctly. So, like, you're all in this situation, and it seems like you're not close. And even further, you're specifically struggling in some areas that are pivotal in the playoff run. They're struggling in the physicality. They're struggling with ball pressure. They're struggling on the glass. Like we talked about, they're giving up an offensive rebound on 40% of their opponent's misses in this first round series. So you seem completely and utterly physically overmatched. So where do the Suns go from here, Carson?
They are in an absolutely brutal spot. And this is obviously, as disappointing as this season could have been, they are not close, as you say, and they do not have the resources to change that. And in a lot of ways, this was a nightmare matchup for Phoenix, which is funny because I think often it was framed as sort of being the inverse, and just there was the concern that Phoenix's pull-up shooting and offensive skill is going to be so great and things are going to get ugly for Minnesota, and can they guard in space with these two big looks? But it ended up being just as convincing a demonstration of bully ball as we have seen. Nobody who can physically hold up with Ant, nobody who can consistently challenge Gobert and Cat on the glass, nobody who could guard Cat in single coverage, and I don't see how those things get better for Phoenix if they continue to build around this big three, because they have nothing. They have one first-round pick that is not either being traded away or where they're getting the worst end of a swap through 2030. They also have one second round pick, and that is the worst end of a swap. They have no cap. They have $160 million tied up in these three guys through 2024. And I agreed with you on the Beal trade in the sense that it was a good value proposition at the moment, just because it was like CP3's contract is bad. Bradley Beal's contract is bad. Bradley Beal is clearly better. CP3 is way over the hill. That's a good trade to make when you're trying to go all in. But the more removed we get from that, the more I think, gosh, I just can't imagine any circumstances in which I would want 3 years of Bradley Beal at this value. And I wonder, like, would you have just been better off sitting through another year of CP, which obviously means you can't contend, but to not have to be attached to this overwhelmingly negative asset? Because when I think about how they can proceed, obviously, in a dream world, you trade Bradley Beal. That's not going to happen. Nobody is taking that on. That is probably the worst contract in the NBA today. I don't think you can trade Devin Booker. To me, just from an organizational morale perspective, that would be so devastating for, like, the plan to be, we're going to mortgage our future. These players who our fan base loves in Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson, and also we're going to give up multiple first-round picks to bring in Kevin Durant, who was in his mid-30s and has sort of a hired assassin feel, and who I don't think the fan base is very attached to at all. And then we are going to build around him, trade away Devin Booker. So no matter what, we're just going to be a solid playoff team. Like, that's the reality here. There is no opening a title window for this Phoenix team. I don't think so. I think ultimately that title window closed after 2022 because CP3 had just regressed too far. It was clear that DeAndre Ayton was not going to be the guy that he was in that 2021 playoff run that they hoped he could ever be. His value depreciated. And so you were just sitting as like an average playoff team. Like, they were on pace to be a 40-something win team with CP3 and Book that year. And then you trade for Kevin Durant. And the optimism is, okay, now we're really going to contend because we have two top 12 players on our team. But that roster was just too far away. And that's how I feel now. That roster is still too far away no matter what you do. I would probably trade Kevin Durant, though, because I don't think you can trade Book. And to me, you just can't run it back with this same core when there are so many obvious limitations. Like, the level of play that you're getting from your role players is not even close to cutting it. Book and KD played as well offensively as they could in game four, and you still lost. They combined for 82 points. That speaks to just the inadequacies of this roster, and you can't build that out using all minimum contracts. They tried to do it this past year, and it just ultimately doesn't work. If you trade Kevin Durant and you get multiple really high-level role players, you get a really good point of attack defender out of that. You get a versatile, maybe switchable big with some offensive skill. Somebody better than Yusuf Nurkic, who I just think ultimately having a slow-footed, non-rim-protecting, non-floor-spacing big is not going to cut it. And those guys tend to get played off the floor like he does positive things. But I just think you really need somebody who can hold down the five defensively when you have the issues that they already do in terms of slightness and just being so meh on the perimeter. If you just get some dogs in here with Book and Beal, maybe there's a higher ceiling there. But honestly, I don't even know if that moves the needle. I think either way, the Suns are just destined to be like a solid playoff team for the next few years. And if they would rather say, let's continue to put Kevin Durant and Devin Booker on the basketball court together because we think that's best for our fans' morale, then I understand that perspective. But I don't see any path here that opens up a title ceiling. They are just so far behind Denver, so far behind Minnesota, so far behind OKC, who is only going to get better as two of your stars are just going to slowly continue to trend downwards. It's an exceptionally brutal situation that they're in.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the Suns have to pick a direction. That direction's either we're going to go in again on these three stars and we're going to try to retool and make this thing work for the next 2 years until it inevitably falls apart, or we do make a trade, which is dealing away Kevin Durant, because I don't think anybody's taking on that Beal contract. And the ironic part is, if we had a time machine, not only do we question the Beal trade, I think maybe you question the KD trade, because you're thinking about the assets that you gave up. You gave up two great 3-and-D wings that just work in a team context and a bunch of draft picks. You know, you'd rather have those assets back, I think, if you were to do it over again. And the thing about Phoenix, too, is it really is just a fundamental roster construction issue. I think the Knicks and the Timberwolves have given us really good blueprints on how to consistently win in the playoffs. Like, both of these teams have one clear, like, offensive superstar, right? Anthony Edwards and Jalen Brunson. Behind them, it is a bunch of guys that are going to defend their ass off. They're going to do their jobs. They're going to play really physical and do their roles. Like, those players are really valuable. And I just don't see anything that Phoenix could do to reach that level defensively that they need to, or to match up physically and on the glass. Like, there's no way that they can reach that level. And we were talking about this last night. So it's like, that's the tough part about trading away Kevin Durant. Is it, do you admit your mistake? Do you sit there and go, we screwed up. We got to redo this thing. Or do you just go further into the void with these three stars and, you know, just kind of look away from the mistake? I don't know. I agree. I think that if you go in on Beal, KD, and Book again, I think you run the risk of maybe potentially losing D-Book down the line because the team is so unserious and so uncompetitive and so far away. Like, you just run the risk of losing everybody. So, yeah, I think you just got to retool. Like, the Suns cannot compete with their cap tied up. They have no money to give to the rest of this team, and it's just going to handicap them from being a serious basketball team. I think the route is to trade KD, and that is such a tough you know, bullet to bite because KD is still so good for how old he is. And you gave up so many assets to go and get him, but I just think that's a smarter decision. I think your team is going to be better off in the long run, and you're just going to be deeper. And I think you got to run it back with D-Book and Beal and hope it works out. But yeah, like you mentioned, Carson, I think the sad reality is the Suns aren't going to be in the championship contention anyway. They've got three teams that are just concretely better than them out West. And one is just so clearly the favorite. And then two are ascending right now. And the Suns are going down. But I would go for depth over star power, man. I don't think you're building a serious basketball team with KD, Beal, and Book, especially with all the money that you got tied up in them.
You know, I thought the story of this season for the Suns from the beginning when the trade first happened for Beal was, will they get a diminishing return on him based on a redundancy, or will they get a force multiplier based on optimization, right? And there were stretches this year where they did optimize, and they'd have these games where they'd have like a 75-80% assist percentage, and they're driving and kicking, and everyone's involved. But for the most part, it wasn't like that, right? I thought, honestly, the report last night, the complete axing of Frank Vogel, which is one of the lamest things I've seen, considering like the players just didn't get the job done, and all of them turned on the coach at the end of the year. And there's another conversation to have about Frank Vogel, because like this is the second team in a row that you're basically going to fire him simply because they don't listen to him, which is maybe that just is a strong indicator that Frank, because I think Frank knows his stuff. I think it more is like, I think Frank needs to coach a younger, more impressionable team. I don't think you can put him in charge of a bunch of older superstars. It's clear. There's back-to-back teams now where even though he's doing his job, they don't respect him for whatever reason. I thought the dead giveaway was that Devin Booker quote about Frank Vogel in the film room, where like he was asked about it, and Devin's response was like a little condescending and a little bit like, yeah, Frank is proud of his film work. Like, and it was very like weirdly diminishing. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, like you guys don't even respect this guy for the work he's putting in to try to help you win games.
On the broadcast, when the sideline reporter said that Vogel specifically said that he wanted them to attempt 40 threes in this game, and it's like, they're not close to that. Like,
they're not close.
That has never, ever been something that they have demonstrated any intention of doing. So it's like, yeah, it doesn't seem like they're listening to him.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't blame Frank at all. I thought that was ridiculous. But I did think it was interesting when I read the article, when I heard the bit about Kevin Durant not being happy with his role and him being stuck in the corner. And there was a specific play. I clipped it. You guys can find it on my Twitter feed @_JasonLT. But basically, Suns worked the ball at the floor, and they set a ball screen for Beal out by half court, and Anthony Edwards falls over and kind of like tweaks his ankle. And in the sequence, Eric Gordon pops to the right wing, and he's standing at the three-point line wide open. And Beal misses him. And instead, Devin Booker's kind of standing in the short corner with Rudy Gobert on him. And one of the biggest issues with the Suns all series is they thought, oh, I've got Rudy Gobert, this is a matchup. It's like, no, it's not. It's definitely not. And so he throws the ball to Devin Booker. And you can see on the right wing, Kevin Durant's in the corner, and he's pointing at Eric Gordon like, he's open. And if you throw it to Eric Gordon, one of two things is going to happen. Either Cat's not going to close out from the corner, and he's going to get a wide open catch and shoot three, or Cat's going to close out, and Eric Gordon can either make the extra pass or rack to the right and kick out to KD, who's going to get an open three. And instead, that doesn't happen, and Booker tries to ISO Gobert, can't shake him because big shock, it's Rudy Gobert, and then he ends up launching like a cross-court pass that hits KD with less than 4 seconds on the shot clock, and he has to take this like impossible left shoulder fade over Nikhil Alexander Walker. And when I saw that, I was like, this is literally like a perfect encapsulation of what KD is saying. And it's, to me, that's not on Vogel. To me, that's on the general manager. When you put yourself in a position where Kevin Durant is spotting up in the corner while guys are you know, missing reads with the ball in their hands, that to me is a strong indicator of like, okay, I could have a Jaden McDaniels over there. Because if all he's going to do is stand in the corner, I'd rather have a specialist. And as in terms of a use of resources, that makes more sense, right? Now, I thought it was a strong signal that the three-star build really only works if they're perfectly complementary. Mm-hmm. And if they're not, it's not going to work. And And there is a redundancy there, really, with all three of them, but especially with Beal and Booker, because you're talking about two guys that can run ball screens and can make plays, but they're not super high level, like run the team playmakers, right? They can't, like Bradley Beal can defend on the perimeter, but that's not like what he's made his money doing in the NBA, right? Kevin Durant, even as a forward, like he there's things that he can do, and then there's things that he excels at, right? And like there's so much of that that overlaps with that group. And so what I wonder sometimes is you almost have to consider looking around the league to see if you could offload one of the stars and get return. The question is which. You guys both say KD. I actually disagree, and here's why. And I Suns fans are going to think I'm crazy about this, but this is just the way I look at it. Is Devin Booker actually good enough to be the best player on a championship team? And I know he got close in 2021, but that was a weird season. That was a season that saw a Clippers team with Paul George and no Kawhi make the conference finals and get two games off the Suns. That was a year that saw Trae Young play in the conference finals. Like that was a little bit of a weird year, the year after COVID, the two or three best teams in the league, like Miami and the Lakers and the Nuggets, were all decimated by injuries and couldn't make it into deep playoff runs. So like it was kind of a weird season. And so let me just quick rapid fire bounce around to you guys. We'll start with you, Logan. Like, do you actually think Devin Booker can be the best player on a championship team in this NBA with the guys at the top of the league now?
Probably not. I mean, I just look at the other number ones across the league. SGA, like Anthony Edwards, is making a really strong case that I can't have him over D Book. And you think about his, like, you know, he's not super impactful two way. No, D Book probably, I'd say no at this point.
What about you, Carson?
I would agree. No, I think he's right below that.
Yeah, he's below that tier. So the truth of the matter is he's not your foundational star that you build a championship contender around, right? But you know what he is? He's the guy out of those three that clearly has the most trade value. So the way I look at it is, if you really want to be honest with yourself, you've got three really good players. KD's like a fringe tier one guy. Devin Booker's below tier one. And Bradley Beal's probably like a tier two, tier three guy, right? And although I think even though Beal was an absolute disaster last night, I thought Beal was pretty good the previous month or so. Like I'm higher on Beal than most. I thought he was a guy that was a strong point for the Suns for many stretches over the end of the season. So from there, the way I look at it is, like rebuilding around Booker is just going to lead to similar results. So for instance, if you trade KD and you get some role players back, or if you trade Bradley Beal somehow and you get some role players back, I don't think you're in a demonstrably better position than you are now, right? But if you flip Devin Booker and you actually get like awesome players back, let me just give you guys one example. I just thought of this one yesterday. I actually texted it into the thread, Carson. You might have seen it. But what if they called Orlando and they're like, we want Jalen Suggs, Jonathan Isaac, and Wendell Carter Jr.? You can have Devin Booker. If I'm Orlando, I'm like, holy shit, I can pair Devin Booker with Paolo and Franz? Like, we'll figure out the rest. Like, this could be a special star pairing. And Paolo would be the guy that you'd look at as the guy who could be a number one in the future, right? And he had he's obviously starting to kind of pop in the playoffs, right? So, like, then if you're the Suns, you're getting back a legitimate athlete at center, a legitimate front court defensive two-way athlete, one of the most exciting ones in the league, and Jonathan Isaac, albeit one with some health concerns. And I'm getting Jalen Suggs, one of the best perimeter defenders in the league, and a guy that can knock down threes. Now I'm running out of lineup with Suggs, Beal, KD, Isaac, Wendell Carter Jr. Now, am I better than Denver and Minnesota and all those teams? Probably not, but I'm way closer to them, in my opinion, in terms of the ability to hang physically. And all I really gave up is a guy that wasn't good enough to be the best player on a championship team to begin with. So, like, whereas if you were to trade KD or you were to trade Bradley Beal, there's just no chance you get that return. Whereas with Booker at his age and at his level, you have a real chance to get really good players back. So, first of all, we'll start with you, Carson. We'll bounce back around, but if you were, or who says no to that deal, Orlando or Phoenix? And does my reasoning make any sense to you?
Your reasoning does make sense. Again, I just think the Phoenix Suns fan base would quite literally have the head of Matt Ishbia. I think that they would hate everybody running their organization. Like, I just think they're too attached to Book. He's the homegrown superstar, and KD is the new guy and the outsider, and he's 35 years old. Like, you're mortgaging your entire future now for a real, real outside shot, maybe at true contention. But I do think that that is definitely a better basketball team than what the Suns had this year. And I do agree that although all three of these stars to me are redundant as not great playmaking, not consistently rim pressuring, not even volume 3-point shooting, primarily on ball players. Like, there's a reason that this offense, even with all these stars, was good, but not great throughout this year. All of their issues beating great perimeter defenders, like who Minnesota has off the bounce, like the lack of real high-end quickness. That is all very, very real. But, KD is different from the two of them in terms of having different defensive value. I think just in terms of the size dimension to begin with. I just wonder, like, that Orlando trade that you proposed, it's funny because I was also thinking about a trade to an Orlando or a New York, like one of these teams that you think, okay, they want that like superstar shot maker to put them over the top, and they have a wealth of good role players. Do you not think you could get two of those guys back for KD? Like, instead of getting Suggs and Isaac and Wendell Carter, what if it's just Suggs and Isaac? Because I don't think that's an unreasonable haul for Kevin Durant. And at that point, if I'm getting that sort of exchange rate, then I would rather have Devin Booker long-term, because I also don't think Kevin Durant is the best guy on a title team right now. I think they are right in the same range to me. They are both right outside the top 10 players in the league. They both have very similar limitations, very similar strengths. And I think that we saw all of that play out in this series. So I don't hate that from like a pure basketball perspective. But I still don't think that team is winning the title, and I don't think they can trade Devin Booker. And I think you can get good players back for Kevin Durant because he's Kevin Durant, and there's going to be somebody out there. Like, think about what the Suns just did a year and a half ago. KD was playing at a higher level at that point, but they gave a ridiculous haul. You're not going to get that, of course, but I still think you can get good enough players to where it's reasonable to say, okay, maybe we could be slightly better giving him up and getting back quality role players for next year.
If this was like 2K, I love that trade, man. It just makes so much more sense. You got two guys who can just go and serve buckets, and then on the backside, they're all complimentary. Isaac's one hell of a defensive playmaker.
Next to KD, too.
Yeah. Suggs is an awesome point of attack guy. Wendell Carter, I think, is really underrated. Like, he can stretch the floor a little bit now. He's gritty, grimy on the block. I like him a lot. But I don't, man. That's the one thing. Devin Booker's the heart and soul of this city, man. I think the fan base would riot. I don't know if they'd show up to games. I understand what you mean, though, like in terms of just straight up trade value. I think you would get more for Book than KD, but I just don't think you can do that to the fan base. But I love the hypothetical trade. I think that's mutually beneficial to both sides. The Magic, who have just this grimy, grimy, nasty offense at points, finally gets an offensive creator who's reliable. And then Phoenix just has more quality basketball players, which is just what they desperately need. So I like the deal. I think that if they can get something like that done where they just get more quality guys in terms of a 2-for-1, a 3-for-1, I would do it. But I'm with Carson on this one, man. KD's the older asset. And I think it's a positive by, it's a positive by subtraction. You were just taking out another guy that is going to need the ball in his hands, that wants to create for himself, and you're just subbing out. That's how I feel at this point with the play of all these guys. I don't think any of them are number ones, but I think just eliminating another guy who wants the ball in his hands is going to do wonders for this team, and getting a guy who's going to do his job. So if it is KD or Book, I'd move off of him. I just don't think you can justify trading Book away from this fan base, man. KD's the older guy. The fans aren't attached to him. I think that would rip the heart and soul out of the Suns fan base.
Yeah, for the record, I don't think that'll happen, because I do think that that would be admitting defeat in a certain sense. And I think that there's a lot of backlash that would come from it. I'm just saying, I don't think clinging to Booker is actually going to be like, you're just going to be where you are anyway. And so I'm saying I kind of view this more or less as a small window to begin with. And and I just think you're better if you flip him as like the more powerful asset to get a return. you know, I was talking through some options with a Suns fan yesterday, a Suns fan friend of mine, and I was just kind of, you know, just kind of putting some ideas out there. And the Knicks related one I came out with, because again, you're looking for a team that has, again, if you're trading Booker, it has to be a younger team, right? Because, like, to your point, Carson, I don't think you can trade KD to Orlando, because why the hell would Orlando want KD? Him and Paolo play the same position, and it's a fundamentally different timeline. Mm-hmm. And you're just more optimistic about the long-term development of Suggs and Wendell Carter Jr. and Isaac anyway, right? Now, when it comes to trading KD, you're primarily looking for a team that is looking for a secondary star, but is on a more urgent timeline. And the Knicks are the team that kind of make a lot of sense to me. I was thinking teams like the Knicks or the Warriors. So the Knicks trade would be like, if you call New York and you want OG Anunoby and Mitchell Robinson, like something like that, would you make that type of move? And I think if the Knicks traded OG Anunoby for KD, there'd be a little bit of a riot because of OG's contribution during this run. So that one's hard to conceptualize. Okay, it's the Warriors. They go after, you know, Andrew Wiggins and Jonathan Kuminga or something like that. Like, Warriors fans would not like giving up Kuminga. Especially under the tightness of the window that they'd have to contend with there. I'm not even sure if the Suns would view Andrew Wiggins as much of a you know, swing piece for them. It's really hard to conceptualize those types of deals because KD's value was fundamentally different when he was traded to Phoenix than it is now. He was viewed in the Phoenix trade as a guy who could put you over the top to win a championship. I don't necessarily think teams are going to see that with the same value nowadays. And again, it's going to be interesting to see. Again, I just pitched the Booker one because, to me, it's about like self-awareness and identifying that, like, as good as Booker is, he needs to be the Kyrie to a LeBron or Luka, not the guy that you're actually building around. And so you don't have that guy. So, like, maybe that is the case. Maybe you look at it more in terms of draft compensation and you flip Booker for just a shit ton of draft compensation, and then you're fun and entertaining and you're a mediocre playoff team with KD and Beal while you build through the draft. Like, I don't know, but like the point is we started this conversation at the top of the topic, but they're just screwed.
Yeah.
There's no real way around it. We're discussing a poo-poo platter of options. So it is what it is at this point. All right, let's move on to Lakers Nuggets. So I think the series is over, personally. I think the Nuggets are going to win convincingly tonight. I think they're going to win by double figures, even if Jamal Murray doesn't play. And the main reason why is I think the Nuggets are better than the Los Angeles Lakers. And I also think that they've been kind of operating at that like 85-90%, like they're engaged and they're trying, but they're not desperate and urgent. Desperate and urgent is a whole other level, and you cannot manufacture that. You can't fake that. You either feel it or you don't. And certainly the Lakers in game four brought an urgency and desperation that Denver doesn't have. I think Denver will approach game five like that because they sure as hell don't want to come back to the Lakers home building for game six and then find themselves in a position where they might have to play game seven. So I think we're going to get a must-win effort from the Nuggets tonight, and I think they're going to win convincingly. That said, if I'm a Lakers fan and I'm looking for some reasons for optimism, first of all, the Lakers have actually won the half-court battle. They're getting 98 points per 100 half-court plays. The Nuggets are only getting 96. Now, the Nuggets are mitigating that on the offensive glass, although the Lakers did hold up better on the glass in Game 4. In addition to that, the Lakers have led the vast majority of the series. So I do think the Lakers have a chance to go in and beat Denver tonight. I just don't believe they will. So let's start with you, Carson. Are you worried about the Nuggets at all? Like Jamal Murray's calf, is that something that you think bring some sort of you know, risk into this equation, or do you think this series is over?
This series is over to me just because we have consistently seen throughout this year the level that Denver plays out in these clutch situations, and it's absolutely ridiculous. When they batten down the hatches, they can defend at a really high level, and they just have the best offensive formula in basketball. That being said, Jamal is really, really, really struggling right now. The efficiency has been absolutely brutal throughout this series. He's been super reliant on those pull-up jumpers, as he often is, but they just are not falling in this one. LA checked a lot of the boxes that they need to in game four, in that you've consistently had great offensive AD throughout this series, who has given Jokic work in single coverage and has been so effective out of pick and roll. His touch shot making has just been incredible. He was also phenomenal on the glass, and I thought that was his best defensive game. You had that hyper-aggressive LeBron that we got similar to game four last year, when I thought he was phenomenal, where he's just not messing around. Like, yes, his jumper has been amazing this year, but he is just going to physically bully you, relentless mismatch attacking some of the guys who held up on him in game two down the stretch, off switches. Jamal Murray, Christian Brown, KCP was his primary assignment down the stretch of game two. Like, he was just bullying those dudes. It was such an efficient offensive performance, the cutting off of the AD short roll. And then you got the D'Lo and Austin Reeves that you've needed all series. Those guys were awesome as pull-up shooters. So, like, that was the vision for how this Lakers team could make this a legitimate series. But I think the moment has passed. I think it's just way too little too late. And Denver has not thrown anything close to their best punch. Like, yeah, what they did in terms of that comeback in game two was remarkable, but this team is having a horrible shooting series. They're 27% from deep. They are starting every single game super slow in that regard. Jamal cannot play worse than he has. I legitimately just don't think he can. Like, this has been such a bad version of Jamal Murray. And so then it's like, with overwhelmingly the best player on the floor, with a supporting cast that has consistently been a lot better. That Lakers supporting cast was so bad games one through three, uncharacteristically so, I would say, but also just this beautifully assembled starting five that Denver has, where everybody fills their role at such a high level. Like, that is so reliable. That is how you go up 3-1 when you are having a bad shooting series. So I don't really see a path for the Lakers. I'm interested in how they approach it. I'm interested in how hard they are doubling Jokic from the jump, because I think that we saw them find some success with that down the stretch of last game. Just even when he's making accurate cross-court passes, at least getting the ball out of his hands, forcing the Nuggets spot-up shooters to beat you when they've been struggling. But I don't think there's a good answer against Jokic. I think he's going to kind of pick you apart no matter what you do. And if the Nuggets come out with intention and they don't get sloppy with the ball like they did in this past game, if Jokic gives a better effort defensively than he has, I think he's generally been pretty poor there in this series. Like, they're just the way better team. So I don't see any prayer for LA winning this series. Like, you are facing a much better team and you're down 3-1, and that team hasn't played close to their potential.
Yeah, you can't overstate how poor Denver's come out of the gates in this series. There's a stretch in this last game too, in the second quarter, you know, they commit 8 turnovers. Like, it's just uncharacteristically bad Denver Nuggets basketball. And on the flip side of this, like, we got a great Lakers game. Like you said, Carson, every box got checked for LA. And yet in the fourth quarter, Denver's right there, like, lingering around. I'm sitting there waiting for Denver to just, you know, it's like, I'm just waiting for Denver to stop playing. Oh, like, I'm going to stop playing now, you know? Like, when you're, you know, you're just joking around and pick up, and it's like, all right, I'm gonna flip it on. We're just gonna close the door here. That's how it felt in game four. I'm just waiting for Denver to stop playing with their food. Like, that's kind of how I felt all series long. And I don't know if we can expect this level from LeBron every night out. You know what I mean? And we got great Anthony Davis. We got D'Lo and Reeves doing their thing. Can LeBron consistently do this? Like, he controlled this last game. And I don't know if we can anticipate this every single possession. The mismatch attacking was brilliant. The cutting off ball, the just shot quality he generated was elite. And I think this series is over. I think Denver is just a better team. There are things that I think that LA can do, but I don't think Denver has played anywhere up to their expectations. And I think we can get a perfect Lakers game and we can get a really bad Nuggets game. And they're always just going to be right there. Like, I think the Nuggets can play their worst brand of basketball and still just be within 10. That's not enough for me. Like, Denver can close the gap, it feels like, at any given moment. And that's why I just don't think you can ever put the Nuggets to bed. And I do think they're going to take care of business tonight. Like, there just comes a point where I expect them to shoot better. I expect Jamal to have a decent game. They're just a better team. And I think the Lakers have to play perfect basketball to beat Denver. There is zero margin for error for the Lakers.
Yeah, well, and they toasted off any margin for error they had in game two. Like, there was a pathway. I had the Denver as a substantial favorite coming into the series, But there was the one pathway for the Lakers was kind of what happened. You steal a game in Denver, and then one of the Nuggets starters kind of gets banged up slash hurt, and suddenly the kind of calculus changes, right? And had they won game two and split in LA and it was 2-2 and Jamal Murray was injured in some way, shape, or form, like then there was a chance for the Lakers to kind of shoot through that gap. But that's not what happened. You toasted off game two, and now it's not so much about the dynamic. Because, like, again, if it was 2-2 and you're going back to Denver, I would have this more like a 65-35 Denver type of thing where I would give the Lakers a legitimate chance because they have led the majority of the series. They have held up in the half court. They have gotten stronger in some specific areas. They've been better at weathering Denver's runs over the course of the series. I thought they were really good in the third quarter of the last game. Specifically, they've really destroyed Denver's defense on the back line. They've had back-to-back games with 70-plus points in the paint. So, like, they've figured out a lot of stuff, but beat one stretch, which was the 20-point blown lead in game two, basically made it so they have to be perfect. And so as a result of that, it's just too much to ask. Like, it's funny, like the one thing that would make me think the Lakers have a small chance of coming back from 3-0 would be if Jamal Murray did not play tonight and it came out that like he literally needed to take a week off because of the calf strain. If that happened, I'd give the Lakers a small chance. But even if that happened, I would still pick Denver because Jokic is still the best player in the series, because they do have two of the next three games at home, because the Lakers do have a tendency to let go of the rope from time to time. And it's not so much whether or not they would do it in game five. It's just at some point before game seven is over, they would let go of the rope for like 10 minutes and Jokic would blitz them by 15, 17 points and it would just be too much and it'd be over. And so I'm picking Denver no matter what. But whatever little tiny crack there was, they blew it in game two. That was the game you have to win. Like, the better team wins the best of seven the vast majority of the time. But there are occasional times when there's an upset, and it usually involves a weird game early in the series and then some sort of injury, right? And, like, what ended up happening is they didn't get that weird game in the beginning of the series, and now they're in a position where they're down 3-1, and it's just too much to ask. So, yeah, I think it's over, but I did think it was worth checking in on. And, like, here's the thing. It's going to be a fun game. Like, I think tonight is going to be a fun game. It's going to be a Lakers team that thinks they can win and a Nuggets team that needs to win. And I think it's going to be, I think we're going to get a really strong indicator of the gap between the two teams. And that's why I think Denver's going to win by double digits. I think they're going to put their foot down and I think they're going to get it done.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider's look at the NBA and the culture surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall will give his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. CJ will bring his A-list comedian buddies to keep it light and fire off some hoops takes. Plus, John will be inviting current and former NBA players, friends, and teammates to join the show as well to give their unfiltered accounts of what really goes on in the league from a player's perspective. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. They're here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. Something I've always been a big believer in. When you try to take projects on yourself, you usually don't know what you're doing. You usually end up making mistakes, and it can be a big headache. And so not only can a professional from Angie get the job done more efficiently, but they also are people that you can support within your community as local businesses. With over 200,000 pros in their network, Angie makes it easy to research, compare, and hire pros to ensure a job is done well. With 29 years of experience, combined with new digital tools to simplify the process, Angie makes completing home projects easy. Consider Angie your hub for all your home improvement needs. They can help you find the best price for your project by comparing quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that will tell you what others have paid for similar projects both nationally and in your area, and the app is free and easy to use. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com, or download the app today. All right, moving on to Mavs Clippers. So this series is so funny because, like, the narrative is has kind of shifted back and forth on these, like, weird concepts. So, like, on the Mavs front, there's all this talk about, you know, Luka on defense and whether or not he can guard some of these guys. And it's like game one, he just gets cooked. And then game two, he like locks everybody up. And then game four, he just gets cooked. And it's it's kind of bizarre. And then on the Clippers side, it's like something that I don't necessarily agree with, this idea that the Clippers are better without Kawhi. That I don't agree with. There's no doubt that Kawhi is not at 100%. I don't think Kawhi being out on the floor barely shooting is the reason why Paul George had 7 points in game three. Yeah. I think that's on Paul George. So I don't necessarily lean into that. So like the narrative is kind of swung on these two concepts. And I think it's silly because the truth of the matter is the Clippers are the Clippers, whether or not Kawhi's out there. They still have a lot of talent and identity that they play with. And then on the Mavericks front, like, they really should stop leaving Luka in these damn switches to begin with. That just shouldn't even be a factor. Like, I cannot believe that through four games, they're still switching Luka onto perimeter guys. Like, they've shown, I've seen it in the tape, they can pre-switch and they can send a guy up that's not Luka into the screening action. They are still yet to try hedging and recovering with Luka on a guy like Terrence Mann or Russell Westbrook that's not a movement shooter. Like, there's still stuff on the table there. So many better options than watching James Harden drive right around Luka Doncic. So, like, as far as I'm concerned, the series is dead even. It was dead even in half-court shot creation going into game four. The game four was a shit show of, like, the good and bad of both teams. I've honestly been generally unimpressed by both teams in the series.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, but, like, here we are, 2-2, game five coming up, I think, tomorrow. Let's start with you, Logan. Where are you at with the series, man?
Well, first, I'm doing the rounds basically everywhere. The people have been clamoring for me to announce apologies to James Harden. You know, I'm going on my world tour right now, Jason, so I guess I'll get it out the way here. I uttered the hallowed W word about James Harden earlier on our show. I called him washed. I was wrong, James. I once again apologize. I got a basket of muffins and, you know, like puppies and, you know, stuffed animals on the way. James Harden's been the best player, you know, in this series, something that I didn't expect coming into this, man. I have been so impressed with him knocking down his pull-up jump shots, getting into the teeth of the defense. Last game specifically, my hat off to James, man. Getting downhill on PJ, getting downhill on Luka Doncic. I do want to mention, I thought the Mavericks just made a fundamental misstep by not having Gafford or Lively out there in the fourth quarter. We got a ton of Maxi Kleba at the five. And I thought with how Harden had 15 points in the fourth quarter on 6 of 8 shooting, consistently got to that floater range. And you got a guy like Kleba, who's not a vertical athlete at all. There's nobody to challenge him at the rim. Like, Kleba's getting beat by Harden on these floaters, and then he's getting beat on the back line by Mason freaking Plumlee, man. Like, Jason, you made a trade for Daniel Gafford so you could play a great vertical athlete and rim protector 48 minutes, 24 and 24, however you want to stagger it. Like, Lively gets 18 minutes. Gafford gets 18 minutes. And you're giving Kleba 21 minutes. I like the fact that Kleba can give you a different look as a floor spacer, as a big physical guy that maybe you want to put on George or Leonard for stretches. But him at the five when Harden is getting downhill every possession, just foolish to me. I want more Gafford. I want more Lively. But James Harden was doing his thing. And on the inverse of this, the biggest key to me, guys, is the fact that we haven't gotten star-level Luka Doncic. This is ugly. This is horrid basketball that we're seeing from Luka. The counting numbers are fine, right? He's 29 points, 10 rebounds, and 9 assists.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're always going to be with Luka. But he's 39% from the field, 27% from deep, 51% true shooting with 4 turnovers a game. Like, this is – and he's just getting abused defensively in some of these games, man. And it's funny. You talk about some of those narratives, Jason. We got game one. Oh, Luka's a bad defender. Luka's a bad defender. And then we get game two and game three, and it's people throwing parades. I told you guys Luka was the best defender on planet Earth. Why didn't you listen to me? And then the pendulum swings back on Twitter. Bottom line, I said this on our show last night, but if Luka Doncic is not the best player in this series with no Kawhi Leonard, the Mavericks aren't going to win. Like, Kyrie Irving is doing a superhuman effort in these horrible offensive stretches from Dallas to keep him in these games. Like, knocking down these tough shots consistently, generating great shots, and Luka's not pulling his weight. I'm glad he realizes it in the postgame presser. He goes, I feel like I'm letting down Kyrie. I'm glad he recognizes it, but to me, it's about getting downhill more, not settling as much for his three-point jumper. Like, when Luka's hitting these shots, it's a good look to go to. And when he gets Zoo on him, it's like he's going to make that shot every time. I just expect that jumper to go in. So maybe keep going to the step back on Zoo switches. But I need him to get downhill more and to get into the teeth of the defense for – it's like the Jalen Brunson quotient. Like, Brunson settling for a pull-up jumper is a good shot. Luka settling for a pull-up jumper is a good shot, but it's not the best shot that you could generate every possession. And what you're doing when you're settling for this jumper is you're leaving yourself susceptible to long rebounds. You're also letting the Clippers defense just keep their breath, get their energy back up, and you're putting yourself in a bad situation in transition defense where you got to go and set up your defense fast, and you're leaving yourself susceptible to easy transition buckets on the other end. So I need Luka to be more engaged defensively. I need him to get downhill more and to generate better high-quality shots for his teammates. And I need him to lean into the physicality of this series. I do want to give a lot of credit to the Clippers. I think they have done a good job with ball pressure and activity and making life hard on Luka. But Luka is not playing anywhere close to his standards or the level that he should be at. And again, if he's not going to be the best player on the court, Dallas is not going to win this series, man. He needs to play like the top three player that we all know he is.
It's a brutal series from Luka, and Dallas is very fortunate that healthy Kawhi hasn't been out there, because the Kawhi we saw in games 2 and 3 just was not close to the guy who he normally is, or I don't think that they would be on even footing in this series. Like, they have been beyond underwhelming. This was a team that I was very high on down the stretch of the regular season, and they've had two catastrophic starts to this series, like two of the worst starts that we've seen from anybody in games 1 and 4. And Luka's just not playing at the level that he needs to. He's not playing close to that level right now. The biggest thing, Logan, is what you hit on, the refusal to consistently get downhill. Luka has attempted 7 shots in the restricted area in this series. In his previous 2 playoff meetings against the Clippers in 2020 and 21, he was averaging 5.5 restricted area attempts per game. And I understand that he tweaked his knee in game 3. So maybe that's a factor, but this was a glaring problem in games 1 and 2. And he is still capable of getting a step off of switches. And when he does, there are good results. He gets a step on Mason Plumlee. He draws a foul. He gets a step off a switch, passes, cuts, gets a layup. Like, when he hits the paint, he just has the best set of options available, because the guy shoots 55% on floaters. He can draw fouls. He can make every pass in the book, every lob, every skip pass, etc. And when he is so overwhelmingly reliant on tough pull-up jumpers and they aren't falling, it's just not good offense. And that's the thing to me. Logan, you talk about how they aren't bad shots. No, in the regular season, they aren't. Luka shoots 38% on step-back threes. He's capable of nuclear performances. That's what he did to the Clippers in their previous 2 playoff meetings. Like, yes, he was pressuring the rim a lot, but he also would not miss his step-back threes. But when you have game after game after game, these shots are not falling. Like, get into the paint, man, because that is where you are most problematic. And I have been so disappointed in him, because Kyrie has had some slow starts, but he's also had these ridiculous stretches. And overall, he's averaging 29 points per game on 65% true shooting.
He's been so good.
With that Kyrie, like, you just have to be winning these games. And Luka, to me, is the primary reason that they are in the spot that they are right now. But you do have to give props to James Harden on the flip side, because he's been the best player on the floor. The efficiency is remarkable. The control of the game. And Jason, you mentioned how they just keep on switching those actions and letting him hunt Luka Doncic, and he has been getting a step so easily in this series for the most part. Games 1 and 4, it's like unbelievably poor defense from Luka. I do want to give them props, at least for in those last 2 minutes or so. They did pre-switch. They did trap to switch. They had PJ Washington just fight through a screen and stay on. They refused to switch. Like, at least for the final couple minutes, they didn't let James Harden hunt Luka like food, and he still made light work of PJ Washington.
He beat both of those guys.
Yeah, it was effortless. He was getting a step so easily. He got a step easily on Kleba. That's the problem. When Harden is like this lethal as a step back shooter, these dudes are having to guard him up tight 30 feet out, and they just don't have the foot speed. So Dallas's defense, there have been sort of bipolar performances from them, but game two was also just incredible shot making. Or sorry, game four was incredible shot making from both Harden and PG. I feel like Dallas should still win this series because ultimately I think Luka and Kyrie should be able to outplay PG and James Harden. And then even though the offensive consistency from Dallas's role players are questionable, and we've seen LA able to trap Luka and Kyrie and sometimes just say, okay, you guys beat us with a 4-on-3, make good decisions, knock down your spot up jumpers. The supporting cast can't always do that, but Dallas still should be able to hang defensively. They still should be able to hang in the physicality. Like, they've just come out and gotten punched in the mouth in a couple series, and the offense has gotten off to brutally slow starts, largely because of the level that Luka has been playing at. If he can turn this around, I still think Dallas should win. If he can't, they probably won't, even without Kawhi on the floor, because you're just dedicating so much volume in your offense to him no matter what, and he's not delivering the return on investment for that right now.
Yeah, to put it simply, I lean more towards the Mavericks to close this thing out in six games, mainly just because outside of two stretches, they've been the better team. It just so happens that those two stretches have been catastrophically bad. like put yourself so far behind that you're hopeless type of bad stretches. And they were both in the first halves of game one and game four. And outside of those stretches, the Mavs have basically controlled the series. And that's the thing. Now, whether or not that reflects poorly on the Mavs as a championship threat, that's another discussion. Because even if they do get out of this series, like, how could you expect them to beat three teams like the Thunder, the Nuggets or Wolves, right, and the Celtics when they just are so prone to these bad, bad stretches? But as far as the Luka dynamic goes, there's a lot of focus on the knee. And like, here's the thing. Everyone's hurt all around the league. Donovan Mitchell's playing on a bad knee. Kawhi Leonard, when he's out there, is playing on a bad knee. Joel Embiid's playing on a bad knee. Everyone's hurt. Jamal Murray's going to play tonight on a bad calf. And the bottom line is even when you are hurt, Luka, you should be able to outplay this version of James Harden. Mm-hmm. You should be able to outplay this version of Paul George. And so, and to make it, just to put it plainly, it doesn't matter. You don't get a little asterisk and you get to move on to the second round because you were hurt. You got to find a way. You just have to find a way. And so again, it's not so much about, I honestly think even this version of Luka and Kyrie is enough if they can avoid the super, super, super ugly stretches. I just think they're a little bit more dynamic in transition. They're just a little bit more dynamic when they get going on both ends of the floor. And we've seen that in their big runs. But yeah, they need to get more out of Luka. They need to avoid some of these ugly stretches. I think they're going to win game five and then come home and win in game six. So I'm picking the Mavericks. But yeah, definitely a strange series. And here's the last thing I'll say on the Luka front. Like, Luka fans, they think this guy's the best player in the world. That's what they think this guy is. And they've been acting all year long like he's been disrespected and he hasn't gotten the appropriate amount of respect and he should have won MVP and he's playing better than Jokic and all these different things. And it's like, say what you want about that Lakers Nuggets series. Jokic has just still been clearly the best player in the series, like by far. And it's like, the reality is if you want that recognition, if you want to be included on that tier, you can't be made to look this ineffective in a playoff series. And again, like, I want to credit the Clippers. I think Russell Westbrook and Terrence Mann have both done an amazing job. I think the big thing has been their back pressure. They're in Luka's head in the sense that he knows if he gets downhill, Russ is coming flying in from behind, trying to do something crazy. And Russ has a little bit of a recklessness to him that I think is a little bit that has Luka a little bit unsettled. And like, again, it's just, I think even the best players in the world are capable of having bad stretches and overcoming them. And I believe Luka will. And I think that we'll see the Luka, I think mid next round after they beat the Clippers, I think we'll see Luka kind of recapture some of what makes him great. But like, at the same time, it's like, next round could be Lu Dort waiting for you. And guess what he did to Brandon Ingram, you know? So like, it ain't going to get any easier. He's got to find a way to figure this out. But to put it simply, like, with Kawhi not really being a factor, you have two must-win playoff games coming up. Are you taking Luka and Kyrie, or are you taking Paul George and James Harden? And I'm taking Luka and Kyrie. All right, before we get out of here, we're going to talk Sixers-Knicks for a few minutes. I went into this series really, really on the fence. And then I ended up picking the Sixers based on their half-court shot creation. And the main idea was I just thought Embiid and Maxey would be able to generate more high-quality shots in the slowdown half-court environment than Brunson effectively by himself. And that did bear out in the first three games of the series in the sense that the Sixers were the substantially better half-court offense. But if it started on film, and I'm watching the game last night or yesterday in the afternoon, and I'm like, wow, they've gone away entirely from Maxey and Embiid two-man game because Deuce McBride and OG Anunoby just have it locked up. They actually went away from it entirely down the stretch. Mm-hmm. I watched every single pick and roll from that game, and I don't even think Maxey and Embiid scored on a ball screen in that entire game, if my film session was correct. Now, I didn't look at dribble handoffs, so I'd have to go back and watch it more closely, but they kind of figured out that action. The ghost screen action with Kyle Lowry. The Jalen Brunson was throwing really good hedges, and Deuce McBride was doing a great job pressuring, and they were rotating out of it. That big block with Precious Achiuwa on Joel Embiid, that was clean rotations that erased that. Embiid in the post, they're able to double team and rotate out of it. Now the Sixers are doing some stupid stuff with their spacing as well, but they've just kind of figured out that half court offense. And then on the other end of the floor, Brunson's getting better and better every game. And the Knicks actually won the half-court battle last night, 93-85 in points per 100 half-court plays. And I thought that was the death knell for this series, in the sense that, like, if you were going to feel comfortable going in as the Sixers and winning game five in Madison Square Garden, a building that is going to be on fire, it is going to be a very difficult game to win under any circumstances, and these are not normal circumstances. And so I think that the Knicks have kind of figured him out. I thought Embiid looked gassed and bad defensively down the stretch as well. I think the Knicks are going to go home and beat him convincingly in game five. Where are you at, Carson?
That's interesting. I still think this series could be very competitive down the stretch. I pick New York. I think that New York is going to win, but I also feel like the best punch that you can see from Philly is a little bit more devastating than what New York can deliver. The ceiling, like what we see in game three, when Embiid is just unconscious as a jump shooter, like that is exactly what you laid out, where the half court offensive skill just exceeds what New York can manufacture. But I do think the Knicks are going to win this series, and I do think that they've been the better team. And there's several components to that. First of all, just the consistent contributions that we're seeing from these role players are remarkable. The consistent effort, the consistent dominance on the glass that they have asserted, like just securing themselves so many extra possessions. That fourth quarter was a slog, and there was an opportunity for either team to just seize the moment and to at the very least knock down some shots. But if you're not going to do that, you have to end possessions. And the Knicks got 11 team offensive rebounds, so including possessions where they like drew a foul hustling for the board. That's 11 extra possessions. You cannot allow that if you're Philly, and there's just been way too much stuff like that. But ultimately, Jalen Brunson is now playing at the level where they're not stealing games anymore. Games one and two, they stole just on the back of heart and role players over-delivering, even though we know those guys are awesome. Like, they had to be superhuman. Now you have Jalen Brunson going, and that to me is what is super encouraging, not just for this series, but for the long-term outlook of this Knicks team, because he's made several adjustments to me that have just made him a significantly better offensive player. First of all, I love how much he's been looking to facilitate over these last two games. 23 combined assists versus just 13 combined assists over games one and two. And I think he's doing a much better job of hitting Isaiah Hartenstein with those pocket passes and dump offs. And the guy just isn't missing his touch shots. I think he's doing a better job of kicking out to shooters. Like, simply put, he took so many tough shots in games one and two, and he's still taking tough shots, but he's also getting himself some easier shots, and he's creating easier shots for his teammates. I also think they've done a really good job of getting him downhill more decisively. You mentioned the back pressure that Luka's having to deal with. We are seeing that affect him, where he's worried about those rearview contests, and way too often he like has a step, right? He's doing his hostage dribble. He has the defender trapped on his back, as he loves, and then he steps back. He negates the advantage. Brunson was clearly affected by the length of Kelly Oubre and Nick Batum and even Tyrese Maxey early, and now he's just, instead of playing that sort of slow down, methodical, let me carve my way to whatever spot around the free throw line, like, he's just going. And so he's getting these much higher quality looks close to the rim. He still can't go right at Embiid, but that's made a big difference. I really liked in game four how much they were having handoffs flow into pick and roll, where now you get a running start into that action. Again, just anything to create separation from these really impressive perimeter defenders in Philly. And then you just have like the special shot creation footwork, like low pickup from the 3-point line where he starts his gathering, he hits the and one floater, the running wrong footed shot over Joel Embiid as the shot clock expires. Like, that's Jalen Brunson, man. That's the guy who we saw down the home stretch of this regular season, who was averaging 35 a game. And when they have that player, then they have the lone superstar who they need for these incredible role players, good spot up shooters, awesome defenders, awesome rebounders to carry you through. And on the flip side, that version of Joel Embiid that you got just isn't going to cut it. So, so underwhelming down the stretch. So convincingly outplayed by Brunson. And they did a nice job on him. New York did defensively, sending doubles at him once they had to match OG up with him because of Isaiah Hartenstein's foul trouble. And they rotated well, as you say. Like, Embiid didn't create a lot of real advantages off of those doubles. I also think his catch point is consistently far at to the point where he's like not in the teeth of the defense. He's not stressing them as much as he could be. And then just wasn't assertive. Like, he gets a great look at 95-91. He doesn't take it. And he frankly tries to get a foul call. Instead, he drives and probably is presuming there's going to be a whistle, because there has been every single time he's entered the paint in this series. And that's not going to cut it, man. So that to me is the difference. If you don't have dominant Embiid and you need great Maxey too, which we've mostly gotten in the series, but you're right about the two-man game not being as effective. And Maxey last game, I thought, was his weakest game. Like, he was just unconscious in games one and two, and they still couldn't win. New York is the more complete basketball team. And if Brunson's going to be the best player on the floor, then Philly may have 2 and 3, but New York has a lot of that next range. Like, they just have so many positive contributors. So again, Philly can still throw a best punch that is tough for New York to counter, but they're not getting there consistently enough. Like, three of these four games have been ugly. They have been tough. And that's where New York is going to thrive. And that's where they're going to win this series.
Exactly. And late in these games, there's been three games that have really, you know, been held in the balance between Philly and New York. And Philly has failed to rise to the occasion. There's two fourth quarters in this series, this last game too, where Embiid is held scoreless. He gets his last bucket with 2 minutes remaining in the third quarter. You can't have that from your superstar. And I thought his decision-making was poor down the stretch. When he's getting these doubles, one, I want to see Embiid get the ball closer to the basket on some possessions, man. When he's got such a physical mismatch, like, OG matches up with him well and is playing hard, like denying him the ball. I want to see Embiid get closer to the basket and just start initiating, trying to get himself some easy looks when he is not hitting his jumper. Two, decision-making out of doubles. When they're throwing these doubles at him, sometimes the best decision is to just to make the easy pass, swing it, and then hope that your teammates are going to swing it and find the open guy when the double's coming, or make the tough pass cross court instead of settling for a jumper. You know, in this last game, New York holds Philadelphia. They don't make a basket from the field. They're 0 of 11 in the final 5 minutes of this game. And like you said, Carson, when New York can make these games ugly, they're one of the best ugly teams in ball. Like, they're going to out-hustle you. Josh Hart notches 17 boards. OG notches 14. And so in these ugly environments, man, New York just fights. Like, they have the dog aspect. And that's where I've really been disappointed with Philadelphia, man. Your offense is inevitably going to go cold at some times, especially when you're going up against such a good New York defense. I've been really disappointed by Philadelphia's effort, man, and on the glass. And that's why I ultimately side as well. If Brunson is going to be better than Embiid or close to his level, give me the team that's just going to make the more effort plays, that's going to make life hard on teams. And down the stretch, man, Philly has crumbled. Philly has crumbled in the fourth quarter of these games when New York just has more competitive spirit, more edge, more fight in them, more, I hate to say the cliche, they want it more, but damn it, New York does, man. I don't see. I want to see a little fight from Philadelphia, man. I haven't seen them fighting, man. I want to see that from Philadelphia. New York wants it. New York is going to go and get it. New York's going to take it, man. Philly has failed to really capture any of these late game moments, man. They have just fallen apart in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, I don't really blame Embiid for the offensive side of things. But on the defensive end, he just hasn't been nearly good enough. And that's the area where I think the criticism of him is fair. He had some bad defensive mistakes down the stretch, losing Brunson. But on the offensive end, like, I really do think it more has to do with coaching. There are too many possessions where Tobias Harris and Kelly Oubre are in positions where they can't be a threat. And a lot of these double teams, part of the reason why the rotations are so clean is Oubre and Harris keep hanging out right underneath the basket. And they're not Precious Achiuwa and OG Anunoby, where when they're down there, they're getting every single offensive rebound. They're just getting in the way. There's a double team of Embiid on the left block where they rotated quickly out to Maxi, and Kelly Oubre was on the right wing and wide open in a position to catch a three. But instead of being ready, he just kind of ran down underneath the basket where Tobias Harris already was. And all of a sudden, Josh Hart could guard both of them and the advantage was gone. And so there's a lot of stuff. Honestly, like, I think Thibodeau has coached circles around Nick Nurse in this series. The offensive rebounds, the Knicks had 11 second chance points out of their 20 in the fourth quarter yesterday. A big part of that was, for some reason, he still has Kyle Lowry out on the floor. And it's like, you already have Tyrese Maxey out there. And more importantly, you've got Kelly Oubre on the ball and Embiid showing high. So you're putting two of your biggest athletes out on the perimeter, and you're asking Tobias Harris and Tyrese Maxey and Kyle Lowry to clean up the defensive glass. In many of these situations, Kyle Lowry is getting matched up with OG Anunoby and Precious Achiuwa, and he's just completely, he's trying to box out. I'm watching him on film. He's turning, identifying the player, sprinting into him, trying to box him out. He's just physically overmatched. And I would get it if Lowry was giving you something more substantial offensively. And look, his playmaking is a value. He can grift his way to the line a few times a game. Like, he's got value there, but not enough to justify it. Is Nick Batum a perfect player to throw out in a situation like that? No, but at least you have a better chance to contend on the glass while also having some more shooting on the floor. And then I think you, in that situation, put Batum on the ball and then have Oubre's athleticism to kind of help you clean up on the glass. But I think Thibodeau's outcoached Nick Nurse. I think Brunson's outplayed Joel Embiid, and that has mitigated any advantage that the Sixers had in terms of personnel in this series. So I think the Knicks are going to close them out in game five. But yeah, there's no doubt the Sixers have that punch. And if they throw it, they've got a chance. But it kind of goes back to what we were talking about with Nuggets Lakers. Do you expect the Sixers to do that three times? I don't.
No.
All right. So before we get out of here today, Carson, you want to tell us what you guys are working on over at NerdSesh?
Absolutely. So we are cranking out a bunch of content throughout these playoffs. We are going live post game. We've been doing it almost every night so far. So if you just have that immediate fix, and if Jason isn't live, if Jason's live, you know, take your pick. I think we all make the right choices. But we are there. You can listen to our shows across audio platforms and also on our YouTube page. On top of those full shows, we are doing some more in-depth video breakdowns, video essays, deep dives into specific subjects, interesting things that we're seeing pop up throughout these playoffs, dominant players, etc. So you can find all that. And then also, if you want more of our content, we are across social at NerdSesh on TikTok and Instagram, and at Nerd_Sesh on Twitter. And we do a lot of fun trivia stuff there on top of clips from the show and whatnot.
They're doing amazing work with the film sessions and the video essays and stuff. Love the NerdSesh guys. Get over there, subscribe to their channel. We will be having them on probably about once a week throughout the rest of the playoff run. I appreciate you guys taking the time to come on the show today. I appreciate all you guys who are listening for supporting the show. We are going to be back tonight after the final buzzer of Lakers Nuggets, which Carson has assured me the Lakers have no chance of winning. So I will see you guys. I will see you guys tonight after the final buzzer. As always, we appreciate you guys. See you later tonight.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
Karol G,
Juan Gabriel,
Christina Aguilera.
What do these three have in common?
You mean apart from impeccable style, chart-topping canciones, and drama?
Facts, yes, all of the above are correct, but most importantly, they're some of the biggest Latin icons in the world. And they're just a few of the game-changing Latin stars we're covering in Becoming an Icon Season 2. Listen to Becoming an Icon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.